Hello, this is Stump, Death and Taxes, and this is Meep, or Mary Pat Campbell. And today is a very special episode because today I am 50 and I am gifting you with five pieces of advice or themes from my five decades. Oh, I'm so wise. No, it's just five pieces of advice, three of which came from my father. And two are, you know, kind of generic pieces of advice that they're kind of themes from each decade. And I'm going to tell you what they are before I go through them. And you can decide whether they sound interesting or not before you commit. So first, be a good animal. Two, the universe is stranger and more wonderful than you can imagine. Three, never pay retail. Four, you can try anything once, or risk is opportunity. So they're kind of the same thing. And five, it's not about you. So you can decide whether to proceed. So let's start with that first theme or piece of advice, which is be a good animal. And this did come from my father. I'm going to read something I wrote actually when I was about 41. And I had already written this. So when I was a little kid, one of my favorite things to do was just get in a comfy chair and read. I'd lose myself in books. I also liked thinking about math and making up new problems. I had bizarre sleeping habits, and I won't begin to explain the sort of things cooked for breakfast by a kid who woke up a couple hours before everybody else. Spoiler alert, it wasn't particularly healthy eating. After one particularly bad spate of being a hobbit in my cozy hobbit hole, eating my junk food, and consuming a bunch of books, my dad, who had similar proclivities, gave me this advice. Be a good animal. This advice was about taking care of the physical side of yourself. Eat well, get out in the sun, get enough sleep. If you're exhausted, nap and realize when you've hit your limit. This has helped me in the past, especially when I realized that a course of action was ruining my health. Remembering to be a good animal has helped me to say no to additional projects when I'm exhausted. Being a good animal has helped me realize I had to walk away from something with loads of sunk costs, a very difficult thing to do. So while reading is still my favorite pastime, I remember to walk out once in a while. I fix oatmeal a lot more than I did as a kid. Ooh, big bowl of sugar. I even managed to get out in the snow this week, so that's when I wrote that piece, if only to clear some of it off my van. As you can see, my son had a lot more fun in the snow than I did. So that was a picture of Dermid playing the snow back in 2015. It helps to step back from advice on how to succeed in business, catch an opportunity, build a career, and remember that the main point is to have a life. My best advice from my dad has helped me with just that. Go and be a good animal. So the reason I wrote that piece was that was on LinkedIn, and I'll drop a link in the show notes, where they were asking for the best advice. And most people, when they were sharing their best advice, was all about career development. And, you know, I can give people career development advice, but, you know, what are your priorities? You're going to die. And you'll notice in those five pieces, none of them were memento mori. And that's because I'm not dead yet. I'll close with that in a bit. In my first decade of life, you did not need to tell me to be a good animal. That first decade, I was being a very good animal. My dad didn't give me that advice until I was about like 13 years old. My first 10 years of life, and this is not thanks to my dad, it was thanks to my mom, who made sure that, of course, I was fed well with actual fruit and not so much sugar. When I was older was when I could cook for myself and take care of myself. I was waking up very early in the morning, mind you, when I was a little kid, but I was playing outside. I was doing all sorts of fun things. And a lot of this was due to my mom because she was a stay-at-home mom for the first decade of my life and for a little bit longer too. And she was always around. That gave me some security. It wasn't only my mom, but my dad's mom, Grandma Campbell, who allowed me to eat dirt, literally, in her yard, and do all the kinds of old-fashioned things kids do. Little kid Meep didn't need this advice. It was older kid Meep who needed the advice. anyone who goes around giving little kids advice, come on. I had a very happy childhood. And I had very unstructured playtime. So if I'm going to give anybody advice with regards to little kids, I'm giving advice to parents, not little kids. Let kids be kids and play around and be good little animals. Yes, as parents, you need to train them to not be animals all the time and to behave properly when there's time to behave. However, for really little kids, that first decade of life, a lot of it is just going to have some fun and playing around with our three kids, Stuart and I, the ones we have together. He also has an older child. We had monkey hour, we called it. That was later in the evening or in the afternoon when our three kids would just go nuts. And yes, within reason, but trying to get some of that energy out before they went to bed. It's good to move your body, as the kids today say, touch grass, but get outside, get in the sun, as much as I don't like the sun. But I do like to walk around. I do actually like to get outside, as much as I joke to people that I don't. I do get outside. I do like walking around. I do like doing rails to trails. That's actually one of the things I support. I don't do very strenuous exercise. I'm not able to do that, but I can walk on level ground for quite a long time. And that's why I like walking in Manhattan, because most of it is pretty level. And I can do that for miles and miles. When I go into Manhattan, I take every excuse to walk up Fifth Avenue and just walk around the city. And there will be more of that in this piece. So yes, be a good animal. Don't forget that side of you and take care of your body. It's not necessarily going to take care of you. I'm not that foolish, but you should not treat your body like crap. It is a part of you. I'm not a Gnostic, if you know what I mean. So you need to get sleep. And actually, that is something that I did this past weekend. I was feeling like crap, and I actually slept like 18 hours or something, because every so often I need to do that. I don't have great health, really, but sometimes you don't have that choice. And sometimes the best medicine you have is just sleeping. It's not great if you're sleeping all the time, but having a very long sleep on the weekend every so often, hey, why not? So my first decade was, you know, pretty standard happy childhood. Second decade was when things really started to happen. So that is my second theme. The universe is stranger and more wonderful than you can imagine. And as you can imagine, that came from my father too. I used to come down, and I've always had strange sleeping patterns, by the way. Waking up in the middle of the night, or just that's the hour I wake up. I often wake up at 3 a.m. and that's it for the day. I have not used an alarm clock forever and a day. So I would wake up in the middle of the night, and my dad would be up. He'd be up late at night, and we'd have our late night talks. And he would tell me, you know, all his theories of the universe. He was the kind of person who liked watching Cosmos and, you know, James Burke Connections and those kinds of programs. And he would tell me his dreams of being an underwater farmer. I'm not joking. And we did go to Epcot Center when that opened up in Orlando. I got to see that in 1984. So that was cool, when I was 10. So this is going into my second decade. And he told me, you know, the universe is stranger and more wonderful than you can imagine. One of the things about, you know, older childhood for a lot of kids, many kids do have that sense of wonder when they're little, but it gets crushed out of them from institutional schooling. And I'm not going to go down that rant, but a lot of the stuff I would read in books and watch on TV with my dad, we'd watch PBS. And then when Discovery Channel came on in cable, that was great. And then there was all sorts of interesting stuff on TV. It, my parents would drop me off at the library on the weekend for hours at a time, just drop me off there. No one would bug me. I went through, I had certain parts of the Dewey Decimal System that were my favorite. And I was an indiscriminate reader. And I was very credulous. I'm not going to, you know, I believed in ESP and all of that stuff for quite some time. And then I came across the books of James Randi and Flim Flam. And oh, man, I had a great time. But when it really took off was when my father gave me the book Gerdel Escherbach by Douglas Hofstadter. Now, he had bought it when it won the Pulitzer Prize, I believe. And, you know, the book he gave me was more or less pristine. He had tried to start reading it, but it was way too theoretical for him. And that's what he told me when he gave it to me. And I was like 12 years old when he gave it to me. And he said, you know, this is too theoretical for me. You'll love it. And I did. Now, mind you, at 12 years old, there was no way I could get through the entire book. I'm not going to pretend I understood. I got through like the first chapter I could understand. I went through all of the Achilles and Tortoise dialogues, and there were other characters, of course, as well. And I didn't understand all of those. I'm not going to pretend on that either. But I went through that book multiple times. And each time I went through when I was 12, like when I was 15, when I was 20, when I was 25, every time, I think by the time I was 30, I was able to go through the entire book. So there you go. You know, keep at it. And there was so much good stuff in there. And because of the things I have learned over the years, so when I was in graduate school, learning about neuroscience, that really helped me with the book. Obviously, getting undergraduate and graduate degrees in math really helped me with the book. This is not necessarily saying you should read this book. It's not necessarily for everybody. There's loads of books out there, loads of great books out there, and loads of great museums, and just going out into the world and thinking. And the book also inspired my first real mystical experience. I was just paralyzed on the couch, like, oh my gosh, there's molecules and electrons and stuff around me, and there's quantum clouds. And yeah, it was crazy. No, I did not take any drugs other than caffeine. So I'm just saying, and it was just, you know, International Coffees, if you remember that brand. Maybe there was a lot of sugar. I don't know. But it's always been the life of the mind for me. And I've never lost that. I've always been into learning and thinking about the universe and engaging with that and always seeing that, you know, things were wonderful. For a lot of people, they think, oh, all of the questions have been answered. No, they've not. I went on to major in physics and math because I did learn about a lot of the unanswered questions or open questions that still existed. I had the great good fortune of going to the North Carolina School of Science and Math for my last 2 years in high school. That was awesome. I got to do various enrichment programs in the summer. The Center of Talented Youth out of Johns Hopkins when I was in middle school. And then I did some other programs. I got to do an internship at NC State University before I went to NCSSM with a statistics professor. I learned Fortran. I learned about asymptotics. That's also where I picked up James Randi and learned. So I taught myself some statistics actually from a textbook. I was working with this professor. Part of this was because I knew how to code. And I'm also very good at teaching myself from math textbooks. I mean, obviously, I can learn from regular classrooms as well, but I can also self-teach to a huge extent, which is very lucky because a lot of math professors suck at teaching math. So it's good to have that skill of being able to learn from books that are well written, obviously. But one of the things that I did that summer, and it's one of the things that I still enjoy to do, was I looked for the abuse of statistics in like parapsychology journals and then other kinds of abuse of statistics. And so that's why I still enjoy looking for scientific fraud and other kinds of hinky statistics. So that goes back to when I was in high school. So that gives you an idea of a very long-term view of these projects. So in any case, some of the things that have still stuck around in my brain since high school times, as it were, there's just a whole, how do we deal with that quantum level of physics to the Newtonian level that we see, you know, in our day-to-day lives? There's a whole kind of metaphysics going on as well, cosmology, and lots of different things going on. So it's, I find it very interesting to think about these things. But I obviously took a switch from physics to applied math. But that's the next decade, of course. All that second decade was just building up a whole store of just basic foundations and knowledge and skills from 10 to 20 and going through just schooling. And it wasn't just in, as they say, institutional schooling, though I, of course, had a lot of opportunities other people did not have. And even though it was public schools, they were obviously specialized programs, but also some private programs outside of schools like CTY and some of these other. I went to a program at Clemson University, and I learned, and this was an important thing, what not to do. I went to a program on architecture in the summer at Clemson, and I learned I suck at it. And it's good to know what you are bad at as well. I do enjoy architecture. Some of my friends know I like to walk around Manhattan and notice architectural details and also yell at buildings I think are really ugly. And there are loads of ugly buildings in Manhattan as well that I detest. Some are gone now, but yes, there's still many that are still there, and I don't like them. And they just don't deserve to exist. How dare they exist in my beautiful city? Anyway, that said, it's still a beautiful world. It's still a wonderful universe. So the third theme, never pay retail. Now, this is kind of a switcheroo. So never pay retail is most associated with New York City, of course. And that's the decade in which I moved to New York. It's really about costs. There's two costs here, opportunity costs and sunk costs, because that's what was really going on in that decade. From 20 to 30, I spent most of this. So yes, I wrapped up college for the last 2 years of that decade in Raleigh at NC State. Then I moved to New York, and I spent 6 years in graduate school. And that was a big opportunity cost. The opportunity cost, my other friends, most of them did not go to graduate school. A few did, and some of them are professors now. And the reason I was going to graduate school is I thought I was going to be a math professor. So that's going to go to the sunk cost effect, but I'm going to go to that in a moment. The graduate school opportunity cost was that I could be doing something else, which is what my friends were doing. It was that first dot-com boom. Well, depending on what you think is the dot-com booms. And some of my friends were making fun of me because they were making bank. They were getting their employee stock options. They were seeing on paper their net worth growing. Around the year 2000, 2001, that did pop, but we're going to ignore that for right now. I had moved to New York. I had assets, and I didn't mention, of course, in that prior decade, my father died when I was 16, and I did inherit money as a result of that. There were two bits of that, and I'm not going to get into that because we're keeping it light here. So part of what allowed me to move to New York and have various opportunities, I was buying with my time and then assets, which I was drawing down. I was buying experiences in New York because I lived in Manhattan for a few years and then I moved to Queens because that's what I could afford. But as a graduate student at NYU, and I had a fellowship and then I was an adjunct there, I was just enjoying being there and I was taking advantage of all the opportunities as a graduate student because I had all sorts of things. Never pay retail, remember, at discount or comped. I went to the Metropolitan Opera. I had a student membership at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I was telling somebody the other day that I used to go there in the summer just for the air conditioning. And it's true because, of course, the art has to be climate controlled. And I didn't have great AC in my apartment. There was a heat wave one of those summers. And I'm just like, I'd go as soon as the Met opened and just hang out in the Japan wing. Great art, of course, but also very cool. It felt great in there. So, you know, and you can, it was very peaceful. There weren't a lot of people that went in there. It was nice and dark. You can chill out, literally. So I had a great time. I used to go to Union Square, go to the Green Market, get great food, talk about being a good animal. I'd walk around. I'd walk up Fifth Avenue. I'd walk up Broadway. I used to be on NYU crew. So as an intramural sport, I was on NYU crew for a semester. I did all sorts of things, went to off Broadway shows, saw Bat Boy the Musical, comped. It was awesome. I saw so many shows while I was in grad school. Now you may be thinking, well, I'm not hearing a lot about, you know, your thesis or your studying. And I'm like, well, I did actually learn a lot. I did pick up a lot of mathematical knowledge and numerical integration techniques that I didn't get quite there. But no, I did get a lot of information. I did learn a lot of mathematical finance, actually, but that ultimately wasn't my area because while I was there and I was considering doing mathematical finance, long-term capital management fiasco went down and I'm like, well, this is total nonsense, which it's not, but I learned more about it after the fact of where the disaster went on, but I learned about that when I was doing actuarial education, and so I got over myself, and that will be my last decade, and I will explain a little more there. But by spending this time in graduate school, I was spending time getting these experiences and learning academic math. Well, you know, there was some practical stuff in there in coding and MATLAB and all of that good stuff. R, I was learning R while my friends were working, not at Google, well, some maybe in the nascent Google, but at AOL and I believe Yahoo, a few of them. And then Alcatel and some other places, they were going down a different career route than I was. I could have gone the tech route, even though my degrees were in math and physics, because a lot of people had degrees in other things, but they had experience. I had computing experience. I knew how to code. I could have gone down that route, but I decided not to. That was the opportunity cost. And then in 2001, I had a wake-up call, just like many other people did in New York City and outside of New York City, where I'm like, what am I doing with my life? And I had to make a decision. And one of the things that could have stood in my way were the sunk costs in graduate school. I had been there for 6 years, or well, actually 5.5 years at that point. And I had a master's degree, but I didn't have the doctorate. Would I walk away from that? So I'm going to read from a piece, you know, an excerpt from an article I wrote about cognitive biases. And so this is from the section on the sunk cost effect. So here's the definition of the sunk cost effect. This is the tendency to take into account investment of time, effort, money, or other resources already spent in deciding whether to continue a particular course of action. The previously spent resources are the sunk costs. Of all the cognitive biases, you would think this one would be the easiest for the economically literate to battle. We know that if resources have already been spent, we cannot go back in the past and unspend them. So any decisions about our future efforts should ignore what has been done in the past. Our cost-benefit analyses should include only those costs that have yet to be paid, and likewise the benefits that we haven't already received. However, this is extremely hard to battle because oftentimes one ego's is bound up in a past decision. Ignoring those sunk costs may make it more likely to make a rational decision to walk away from something that is a poor bet going forward, but then it would also mean admitting that a previous choice made was wrong. How often has one seen a project limp, bleeding money to the bitter end because someone had to make a big bet and couldn't admit it hasn't panned out? Consider the tragedy on Mount Everest in 1996, which ended in death for many climbers due to a bad decision influenced by several cognitive biases. One of the safety rules formulated by expert climbers was that if one couldn't get to a certain point on Everest by a certain time in attempting to summit, you were to return to camp. But the climbers had worked so hard and paid so much money to get to the summit, they felt they couldn't turn around even though they'd overshoot the time deadline by 2 hours. They ignored their own safety rule due to sunk cost effects. There were other biases also at play, such as the recency effect, where the climbers were biased by recent weather experience on Everest, and overconfidence, where the lead climbers had so many successes, they underestimated the chances for trouble. So that's one of the situations, and yes, I did a switcheroo on you with regards to the never pay retail. This is really about opportunity costs and sunk costs. I learned how to make a decision ignoring the sunk costs of the many years I spent in graduate school. And I really only spent, thank goodness, only my time. I had gotten paid to go to graduate school, and I had spent money not on graduate school tuition, but on having a Manhattan apartment. And I had gotten so many experiences out of living in Manhattan. And then I had done a down payment on my co-op apartment in Queens. And it's because I wanted to live in New York. I love New York. Other people who hated, so you could have had cognitive dissonance if you hated New York City and were sticking it out trying to get a PhD, but I actually wanted to be in New York. So I was trying to figure out a way that I could stay in New York and what kind of career I could have. So I was getting towards 30 years old and trying to figure out, I wanted to have kids. I wanted to have a certain kind of lifestyle, and an academic lifestyle wasn't going to cut it. And that's where I came across the actuarial profession. So those were my first three themes. Okay. Be a good animal. The universe is stranger and more wonderful than you can imagine, and never pay retail. So for number four, we've got, you can try anything once, or risk is opportunity. So the you can try anything once is from my dad, and that was kind of a sarcastic remark, and you can think about that. And risk is opportunity is, of course, the motto of the Society of Actuaries. Now, I started pursuing the actual profession when I was 28 years old. I actually was looking at various finance opportunities, not just actuarial. But the way it worked out was I took the first two actuarial exams in the fall of 2002, and I sent out a bunch of resumes, like January 2003, and I basically got one callback from TIA Cref, and I got the interview, and I got one job offer, and that's all I needed. Oh, and did I mention I was very pregnant with my first child at the time? And I gave birth in May 2003. So yeah, a lot of what's going on at the time. That decade, and I wasn't 30 yet, obviously. So that's rounding out. So, you know, I'm kind of smearing these decades across each other. But I just kind of went for it. And you can see, I did take a lot of risks in this period, but some risks are riskier than others. I had 3 children from 2003 to 2006. I had originally intended to have more, but that didn't happen. You never can really, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch kind of thing. You don't know what you're going to get. I had multiple jobs in a very short period at one point. That happens too. I tried a lot of side ventures and some definitely did not pan out. You know, a lot of things occurred in that decade. In 2010, so when I was 36, that's when my chronic pain situation, I collapsed at work. My chronic pain situation started and all sorts of things went down. So a lot of the stuff that was going on then, you know, you don't know when you're in the middle of it. And you can look back at it, and a lot of bad things happen and they passed. One of my most concentrated periods of learning was that time when I had the chronic pain, and I didn't know that's what it was. Actually, originally, I thought it was an allergic reaction. When I went to the ER 3 times in 1 week. And by the end, I knew it wasn't an allergic reaction, but I still didn't know exactly what it was. I knew it was something neurological by the end of it, though. So, you know, I'm still dealing with it now, obviously, but it keeps changing over the years. So that's been, you know, 14 years going now. I'm still here. Yay. It's not MS, but that's all I can tell you. I can tell you what it's not. But the thing that I really learned in that decade, in trying a lot of different things, a lot of things people just don't even try. At the actual outpost, RIP, people would make fun of me that I would say, just do it. A lot of times people would come up with ideas that really actually had low barriers to entry. They just had to go and do it. And the risks were actually very low. Some of the stuff I did was actually very risky and did have serious repercussions. And I'm not talking about my health situation. Not necessarily money, but the situation was that a lot of people have fear of failure, where the failure part is just embarrassment of not having succeeded. For me, that's not enough of a deterrence. I'm fine with failing and being, you know, not happy that it didn't succeed because, okay, that didn't work. Let me try another thing. I would rather have tried it and then it didn't work. Oh, well. Now, of course, I don't have that luxury in terms of trying everything. And yeah, what was that? Zootopia, try everything? Well, I can't. I know I can't. But, you know, when you're young and full of piss and vinegar, as it were, that is the time to try everything. Why not? Okay, maybe you'll have egg in your face. So what? And that will morph into my next thing. But let me just hold off on that for a moment. Because this goes back to when I was in high school. I remember in high school, people telling me, oh, you were always right in a particular, this is my favorite teacher's class, Dr. Kalina. You're like, oh, you were always answering questions and you were always right. No, I wasn't. No, I was always answering questions. That is correct. I was always trying to respond. And what people didn't realize is that was not usual for me in my prior schools. And I didn't respond in my prior schools, not because I didn't know the answer. I knew the answers in my prior schools. That's why I didn't respond. I knew the answers and I knew I was correct. That's why I didn't respond. I needed to give other people a chance, number one. And number two, what's the point in responding if you know you are correct? I didn't need someone to give me affirmation. I only would answer if I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure and I needed to know what the correct answer was. So in Dr. Kalina's classes, I actually wasn't sure if I was correct. And that's why I would answer. A lot of the times I wasn't correct. What's interesting is the other students didn't notice all the times I was wrong. I noticed them. I noticed the times I was wrong. And I would remember that and then correct. So a lot of times your own failures are more noticed by you and are going to have a bigger effect on your own learning and your own adjustments than on anybody else. So just keep that in mind. So that's been the first four. Now let's get to the fifth decade, and that's, it's not about you. It's about me. No, I'm kidding. It's not about me either. It's not about you is something I've had to say to lots of people. Sometimes it's because they were mistaken of what I was talking about, and I wasn't talking about something dealing with them. But a lot of people make themselves unhappy because they think that, I shouldn't say they think everything's about them, but they're very worried about what other people think about them, or how something is affecting them, or they, you know, why me? Why is this happening to me? Without considering, well, you know, bad things are happening to everybody all the time. And frankly, if you go through life, I mean, I'll do Princess Bride, life is pain. It's going to happen to you at some point. A lot of the stuff I elided over, my father died when I was 16. My Aunt Pat, I was named after, died when I was 15. I've mentioned the chronic pain in this last decade. So in 2017, Stuart was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. And then I didn't mention, of course, my youngest child. He's autistic, but no, not in that high functioning way, just in the, you know, not terribly verbal for a long time, but he's verbal now, but it's very limited, and et cetera, et cetera. And he's likely to need to live in a group home and have a lot of support throughout his life. Those are just my specifics. Everybody has their own struggles, and that's the thing one needs to remember, because if you just focus on, oh, you know, oh, it's so bad, on your own difficulties, you're going to have a real hard time of it, and you're always going to be in pain. I mean, I'm always in pain, but if I focused on that all the time, I'd never get anything done. I offer it up. I mean, being very Catholic for a moment, I offer it up, ask for, you know, the strength of perseverance and do what I can. But, you know, sometimes physically I can't. So with regards to, it's not about you, it doesn't mean don't take care of yourself. That's not what I mean. I mean that the center of the universe is not your life, but to look outward, to focus on things beyond yourself in the life. Try to, you know, we're all in this together in terms of none of us get out of this alive. You knew Memento Mori was going to get in here somewhere. And the best thing we can do is to help each other. One of my favorite pieces of literature, of course, is Dante's Divine Comedy. And my favorite part of the Commedia is the middle part, which is Purgatorio. I always love the middle parts of big, you know, epics kind of thing. The beginning, you know, that's Well, of course, Inferno, very vivid, etc. A lot of people get stuck on that. And then Paradiso, you know, you've got the angels and it's angelic and it's very beautiful. But Purgatorio, that's the nitty gritty. And one of the things about Purgatorio, that's the one that's actually centered around the deadly sins, not Inferno. And envidia or envy is seen as actually the most destructive of all the sins. And that's the one where it's like an acid that is eating away at the connections between people. That's more than pride. That's more than greed. It's opposite of love. Love is wishing the good for the other. Envy is wishing ill for other people, that you delight in their pain, you delight in evil happening to them, and you actively wishing bad happening to them, and then you also resent good happening to other people. That's envy. So this is part of it's not about you. And a lot of people will get hung up on this when you are thinking of things only from your own perspective. So it's not about you. So this is, I'm getting a little heavy here. Let me get a little lighter of what it means from other perspectives is that often, you know, like when I'm writing for the Substack or doing the podcasts, I'm trying to think of, you know, what will work better? How can I better write this? Or how can I make this graph easier to understand? This is a work in progress. And you may have noticed how some graphs have changed over the years where I'm actually graphing the same entities. It's something I go back to over and over again, because it's not how I prefer to look at things. I understand how things are working in my own brain, but I'm trying to see how to be more effective in communicating to other people. So it's not about how my brain works. It's how I can reach other people and how can I communicate to other people and how do they see things. So that's one way to look at it. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about how other people are and what do they need and what do they need to hear? What do you, the person listening right now, need to hear? Getting away from, I don't need to know how I think. I know how I think. I need to know how other people think. That's what I need to know. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. I need to know what's outside my skull. What's inside my skull is not that interesting to me. What's outside in the universe? See, going back to the universe is more wonderful and strange than I can imagine. It's a huge universe out there. It's wonderful. It's interesting. And what's inside this little nutshell here, that's not as interesting. This has been the last 5 decades for me, and you may have noticed, well, where's Memento Mori? Well, I'm not dead yet. Someone else is going to have to write that story after I'm dead. That will be the last decade for me will be the Memento Mori, but you know, what's ahead for the next 5 decades? I don't know. I try not to anticipate trouble, so that's one of my mottos. It will find me out, to be sure. I've had plenty, and I'm sure there will be others. Maybe in decades to come, it will be Embrace the Suck. Who knows? It might be It's an Adventure. That's from my dad. there could be all sorts of mottos for me in the future. When I was a kid, I made myself a coat of arms with the motto, enjoy life. I'm obviously already enjoying life, so that could fit any decade for me. So that doesn't really point out any of the decades. So again, be a good animal. The universe is more strange and wonderful than you can imagine. Never pay retail. You can do anything once, try anything once. Risk is opportunity, and it's not about you. So go out there and enjoy life. Happy birthday to me. Bye.